Today is Wednesday. It's April 27th, 2022. It's 2:37 in the afternoon. And hi, this is John Williams. You're listening to The Mincing Rascals, and you can listen to me on WGN Radio, weekdays from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the discouraged Bulls fan, and I'm also the writer of the Picayune Sentinel weekly newsletter, and I appear occasionally in the Daily Herald.
Eric did a deep dive into the problem with the NBA and the three-point shot, or the value of the three-point shot. Let's leave it at that, and we'll get back to that a little later on. I know people listen to the Mincing Rascals to hear us break down NBA playoff games, so we don't want to deny them of that. Mayor Lori Lightfoot, guys, either because she's running for re-election or because she really wants to help strapped Chicagoans, or maybe both, wants to give people $150 gas cards or $50 transit cards. This week, Chicagoans were also able to sign up for $500 universal cash payments. In the first 48 hours to sign up for the cash assistance, 90,000 people applied. And just before we came into the studio today, the mayor's plan for the gas card squeaked through the city council. The vote was 26 to 23. So imagine the trifecta Illinoisan who could get a $150 gas card, a $500 monthly assistance check, and sometime this summer, a $10,000 student loan forgiveness. President Biden is revisiting that, and now it sounds like it might happen. But back to the mayor's thing for just a minute. 26 to 23 is a win, right, Austin? How do you score 26-23 on that?
Yeah, in Chicago, it's a win, but it's certainly not the way the mayor wanted to win. So that vote really isn't on the way Chicago City Council works. It's not on the merits of the policy proposal itself. It hardly ever is. It's essentially a proxy vote for whether or not you want Lori Lightfoot reelected and how much political clout she has to punish you if you don't vote for her. So that if you see it as a proxy vote for her leadership, that's not exactly a victory for her in a city that's known for a rubber stamp city council. It's notable that these city cards have the mayor's name on them. I'm sure there are not the foes of Mayor Lightfoot are not happy that the folks in their ward are going to be getting cash on a card that has the mayor's name on it, and probably see that as a campaign ad, which it totally is, and is completely inappropriate. So I guess the vote is not surprising in a sense. So those will be going out to folks. And I will just remind everybody, Chicago has the lowest credit rating of any big city in the country. And we're printing out this money to give to people throughout the city. And it might feel good now to do that. But when we're back, maybe on the Mincing Rascals in a year, talking about how the city's budget is cratered, people should remember the fact that we are spending wildly right now on things like this.
Total is what, $12.5 million for the giveaways, right? Isn't that the cash value of that? So that's in the scope of things, the city budget, that's not a lot. But there's some really good questions about this whole initiative. Alderwoman Maria Haddon of the 49th Ward pointed out that everything is more expensive, food, housing. So why is the city subsidizing gas? 40th Ward Alderman Vasquez said that we've been told for 3 years there's not enough money to fund any programs. But as soon as Willie Wilson starts giving away gas, the city suddenly finds money in the couch cushions, is what Vasquez said. So it's a strange initiative, and it does have the feeling of a stunt. I'm separating out the gas and transit cards from the cash assistance, the 5,000 households that are going to get this cash assistance. I think that's a different sort of animal here. That's an attempt to see what basic universal income would look like and how it might affect a city or affect families that get it. This other thing, just as sort of this one-time giveaway by lottery, it just continues to have a feel of a political stunt.
It's like it's a raffle, and I think I remember right next to our old office on LaSalle and Adams, there used to be this big bus station ad for ROMS readers, like Rahm Emanuel's like reading book club or something. And ostensibly, it's like, yeah, get kids reading all the same book across the city of Chicago. Like, what does that have to do with Rahm Emanuel? Why can't it just be like the Chicago Readers Program? It's taxpayer money. You see the same thing with sort of like when the Park District puts on, you know, a jazz show in Millennium Park or something, it'll have a big Lori Lightfoot there, Department of Culture and Special Affairs. I can't exactly remember. DCASE is the name of the department. And I'll have the mayor's name there. Daley would do this all the time. You had Blagojevich on the open road tolling. It is a tried and true political tactic in Illinois to get free campaign advertising ahead of an election. I will say that the universal basic income stuff happened. I believe that was passed probably around a year ago. It was passed, I think, in 2021. So it doesn't as much have the brazen feel of kind of a political campaign.
Yeah.
Whereas the raffle for these cards absolutely does.
Well, the timing is interesting, though, isn't it? Because money is just going to people. You know, it's sort of like that I mentioned when we set this up, the $10,000 student loan forgiveness thing. The three of these things lined up in a row are frustrating to people who have paid their own bills and struggled their own struggles, and nobody ever came to their aid. And I'm not sure that it's going to work. I think it would completely backfire on Joe Biden if he gave $10,000 to people that owe on student loans. And I'm not certain that a cash card with a gas card with Lori Lightfoot's name on it is necessarily going to move the needle much for her.
I would agree with you, John. I think that voters are going to be cynical about this political ploy that we see. We've talked about the student loan forgiveness issue before, and my view is that if you could somehow make sure that you're not giving it to people who decided to go to schools like, you know, Ivy League schools, and they accrued a whole bunch of debt, and then all of a sudden they're making good money now and they want their loan forgiven, I think that that's kind of thing will really stick in people's craw. If you've got someone who had, say, gone to a state school and is still mired in debt, I can see forgiving loans like that, especially if people are behind the eight ball financially. It would be really stimulative to the economy to do that and really help people out. But I think people really chafe at the idea of, like, you know, I didn't go to Brown. I didn't go to Harvard. I went to Illinois State. I went to U of I because I couldn't afford it. And now these people who took out huge loans to go to these schools suddenly want their debt forgiven. Heather, who is not here, Heather Schroen, has argued with me about whether we should index this for income, you know, make it means tested. She thinks that would be cause a whole bunch of other problems. I don't want to speak for her, but I know that there are people who really say we should just do this and not mess around with all the paperwork. But John, you talk to people every day and you hear from them that this would really be galling to people.
Hostility,
right?
Comes through right away on this, even as we just explain it to them, even as some people are like going to be the beneficiaries of it. I heard from somebody today that said, well, this would be good for me, but I still think it's wrong. I don't think we should be doing this.
I'm less concerned about the means testing, even though I think the best reason to do means testing, if you're in favor of the program, is to prevent salacious headlines about, you know, a guy driving a Cadillac who's getting a $10,000, you know, loan forgiveness for his medical degree or something, and that casts doubt on the entire program and makes it much less likely it'll happen in the future. So I think there's like a very kind of good political reason for doing it, as well as a policy reason. But the real problem with student loan forgiveness for me is less on that side. It's more the fact that you're rewarding a system that's completely broken and doing nothing to prevent massive growth in student loans in the future. You're not even fixing any kind of problem long term. There's not a bank that is really chomping at the bit to give a 18-year-old a $200,000 loan to get a sociology degree. Like, that's a really horrible bet for any financial institution to make.
Right, yeah.
The reason that this is happening is because it's propped up by the federal government and they're backing all of these loans, and people are getting way overextended. And these institutions of higher learning have taken complete advantage of it by jacking up their tuition. So it's this constant reinforcing cycle of more aid, higher tuition, more aid from the federal government, higher tuition, that doesn't stop. We actually had a really cool report at the Illinois Policy Institute that came out yesterday, maybe this morning even, on tuition in Illinois. It's gone up around 50% adjusted for inflation over the last 10, 15 years. And now almost half the money half the spending for higher ed in Illinois, I believe it's around 44%, doesn't go to higher ed, it goes to pensions.
Exactly. I think the point you're making about how college tuition and college salaries for administrators and so on have vastly exceeded the rates of inflation, and the easy money that's available to students for loans has fueled that. There's absolutely no question about that. College costs too much, and they need to rein in those costs. And that, in the long run, is going to help people in this economy. It's going to help the education system more than this sort of one-time Band-Aid fix. And also, you talk about stimulating the economy. My understanding of the current economic situation is that the reason we're seeing the hyperinflation right now, one reason, is because of excessive stimulation of the economy with these COVID relief payments. That this was predicted to be inflationary, and it has turned out to be inflationary, along with supply chain issues and other things. I don't think the economy needs that kick right now, given the inflation rate, given the unemployment rate.
Yeah,
I'm not an economist, but that's my take on the situation.
Nor am I, although tell that to the, I'll just quote from the Wall Street Journal, 40 million people who owe around $1.6 trillion in federal student debt. Well, we do a commercial on the radio for an attorney, Ray Kaplan, who works in student debt relief. And what is the number? Over a million people owe more than $200,000 in student debt. A million plus owe more than $200,000 on their student loans. I don't know how people sleep at night when they have $200,000 in student debt, or $75,000. Maybe one of you guys still have that or know someone who does, but that's just so burdensome. Here's what I would do if I were king. After your sophomore year, you have to check in with the school, and they have to ask you, what are you majoring in? When do we project you're going to graduate? And how much do you owe? And if at some point the numbers aren't good for you, then you can't go to our school anymore. You've either got to change majors or go mow lawns, get some money, find a way to, we're not going to be partner to your crippling debt. And that's what we are. That's what we're doing. I am angry at the schools that participate in this because they got nothing to lose.
There's no incentive for them to do what you're talking about, John. And again, I do want to circle back to the fact that you've got someone who is absolutely suffocated by $200,000 of debt or $100,000 in debt. Absolutely, there should be a way that those people can dig out from under so that they can buy houses and cars and they can have the lifestyle to which a lot of people aspire. There's no question about that in my mind. I think that if you were to figure out a way to target a program of debt forgiveness or debt restructuring for some of these people, for all these people who are truly underwater on this, then I think that you would not get the kind of backlash that we were talking about, someone driving a Cadillac home from his medical office going, $10,000 for me to help pay off my medical school.
Allowing people often forget you can't declare bankruptcy on these loans.
That's right.
Which is a huge problem. That would certainly help with debt restructuring for a lot of people.
You can't reset the interest either.
Right. And so the fact that you have these schools that were floating on and growing huge payrolls off this easy federal money, administrative payrolls, people that could have been perhaps helping students understand the debt that they were taking on, and instead were doing all sorts of other things with it, it's morally reprehensible. And none of those institutions are held to account for anything under any of these plans. Their federal money isn't contingent on graduating students with lower amounts of debt. There's absolutely no change in any of their practices under any debt forgiveness plan that I've seen.
Just to make this thing crazier, and then we can leave it, but Chuck Schumer and Elizabeth Warren are still advocating for not $10,000 in student debt forgiveness, but $50,000 in student debt forgiveness. My son owes more than $10,000 on his student loan, and the advice he's getting now is, don't pay on it. You still have forbearance. You don't have to pay. It's tempting because you could pay directly down on the principal, which is very attractive. But if they drop 10 grand on Griff, his problems are solved. It almost seems like we shouldn't do that. The country I live in, you borrow money, you pay money back. That's what you're supposed to do. And yet they're dangling this forgiveness in front of you. So are you a fool if you're paying your fair square debt? I don't know.
Well, and you know, if they were to say that you can declare bankruptcy on these student debts, then the people who lend that money would stop doing it.
Guys, are we worrying too much about a world in which Elon Musk controls Twitter and then Donald Trump tweets? The Wall Street Journal today was very moderate about this. Maybe not surprising, but after Neil Steinberg's piece in the Sun-Times and a lot of us gnashing our teeth this week about what the world's going to be like if Elon Musk unleashes whatever forces he wants to on Twitter, I wanted to just mention what the Wall Street Journal editorialized. And here's just a couple paragraphs. They said, "What a gamble for Mr. Musk, who argues he can unlock value in Twitter that its current leadership cannot. The financing proposal he announced last week includes $21 billion in personal equity. That amounts to roughly 10% of his net worth. As for collateral on debt, Mr. Musk would also pledge about a third of his Tesla stake. It isn't every day that the world's richest man makes a bet like this." And then they write, "If Mr. Musk can strike a more satisfying balance on content moderation, maybe he's right about Twitter's hidden value. Current management is correct that most regular social media users don't want a daily bath of Russian bots, jihadist propaganda, noxious harassment, and so forth. Ditto for advertisers, who represent about 90% of the company's revenue. Yet Silicon Valley's tech lords have decided they want to be the arbiters of speech on political topics like climate change and the origins of COVID. Nudging the moderation dial back several notches might promote broader engagement, though expect progressives to scream." At the end, they say maybe he doesn't know what he's getting into here, and that free speech doesn't necessarily mean all speech. But I don't think the people at the Wall Street Journal are fools, and they don't seem to be too worried about what Elon Musk is up to or what Donald Trump might say. I want to introduce to this conversation Jane Kirtley. She is the Scylla Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota. She's the director there of the Scylla Center for the Study of Media Ethics and Law. Jane, welcome to the Mincing Rascals podcast.
Thank you, John. Nice to be here.
Where are you on this, Jane?
Well, I think everybody is in a wait-and-see mode. We know that Elon Musk has utilized social media and Twitter in the past to attack people that he disagrees with. I'm not convinced he's the champion of free speech that he presents himself to be. I think there's a difference between free speech and speech for which there is no accountability or no consequences. And I suspect that going forward, he's going to learn that his laissez-faire attitude may play okay here in the United States, but he's talking about European involvement as well, world dominance, and he needs to recognize that the EU has legislation that is already being used against social media to force them to take things down. So he'll have to straddle that world and decide whether it's worth it for him to pay big fines or have big lawsuits brought against him, or whether he's going to try to somehow geolocate with Twitter mm-hmm. and block it in countries where there are more stringent rules and regulations.
And those are his problems, which I don't care about. I don't care if he makes money or loses money. Seriously, I appreciate that perspective, and I'm somewhat familiar with what you just said, but I'm more worried about what impact it would have on the election, what impact it would have in the United States, maybe even on COVID as we phase out of the pandemic. I mean, what's the worst case scenario here from your standpoint, Jane?
Well, I think the worst case scenario would be if the newly designed Twitter continues to have a degree of credibility with a sizable portion of the population. If it really descends into a complete and utter cesspool, I suspect most people will leave it in droves. I don't think the public is looking, as you suggested. They're not looking for disinformation and bots and things like that. And so if this is truly going to be the Wild West out there, I think he will inevitably drive away a certain and maybe a very sizable segment of the people that have been Twitter users in the past. What I worry about is if he actually figures out how to negotiate this and to allow a certain degree of disinformation. We know there's an audience for that out there. And if it has a degree of credibility for a certain segment of the population, could it skew the next election? Of course it could. We know that. We know that Facebook contributed to the last election, the outcome of the 2016 election. So, of course, it could have an impact. And, of course, if he does put the guardrails up or reinstate the guardrails, then he's going to disappoint a lot of the libertarian conservative views who claim that they are being stifled by the restrictions that exist currently on social media.
As someone who is the furthest left on this panel, I would agree, though, that Twitter and Facebook crack down too hard on people who are asking questions about Hunter Biden's laptop and were asking questions about the lab leak theory with the coronavirus, that there was just an attempt to really squash certain kinds of expression that were in bounds. And I think there's a difference between that, between, say, mask skepticism or vaccine skepticism, and if there's a difference between that and then like a theory that there's a ring of pedophiles operating under a pizza parlor in the basement of in Washington, D.C., that you need to figure out some way to distinguish between areas in which people disagree, reasonable people disagree, and it may be a somewhat fringe element, but that you can't say, well, we're only going to allow mainstream opinions on our site. That I thought both Twitter and Facebook went too far. I do worry, though, that if you just fling open the doors and say anything you want to say about anybody is fine, we're not going to moderate speech. It's going to be a place where anyone can spew whatever nonsense they want. That it will create this toxic environment, and with any luck, it will drive people away to a different platform that offers a little bit more moderation.
Well, just remember that the phrase, "I'm just asking questions," has been weaponized by a lot of people on both the right and the left to spread falsehoods, disinformation. I'm not talking about things where there's a genuine basis for disagreement, or, you know, where the science is not yet settled. Speculation is a healthy thing. It contributes to the marketplace of ideas. But remember that you can say an awful lot of toxic stuff under the guise of just asking questions. And I think you're correct. It's very difficult to draw that line. And as John was saying there, and I guess the Wall Street Journal did too, there's a real danger when you've got essentially the richest man in the world deciding what public discourse is going to be. The one thing that he has said he is going to do, and I'll believe it when I see it, is that he will release the algorithms that Twitter uses to determine content, what you see on your feed, what gets the highest ranking, that kind of stuff. And that's a degree of transparency that I wish we had with all the social media companies. Mm-hmm. Again, he may do it. I'm skeptical that he will. But if he does, that will tell us a lot about who's making those decisions, because right now it's pretty opaque.
One interesting thing that I feel like is left out of a lot of the punditry on Elon Musk is the question, compared to what? So Twitter, before Elon Musk bought it, a lot of Twitter stock was owned by the sovereign wealth fund of Saudi Arabia, which is not exactly like a scion of, you know, free speech and open journalistic principles. There's a great documentary called The Dissident about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi that talks about how Saudi Arabia used thousands, tens of thousands of bots on Twitter to harass journalists, to control the political narrative in their country, while being one of the largest shareholders of the company itself. I would prefer that someone who at least openly espouses free speech principles owns that platform versus, you know, a brutal autocracy in a country that is weaponizing the platform with tremendous misinformation, you know, against their own people. And I think Eric is right. There have been some really high profile mistakes made when we think that a centralized authority can call balls and strikes on what is misinformation. You end up with these really huge mistakes. And I think
give me an example.
Elon Musk has obviously said,
give me an example.
I think New York Post getting completely kicked off, a large media institution getting completely kicked off the platform for reporting on a story that turned out to be true would be one, probably maybe the most high profile example of this.
What was
that? That was the Hunter Biden laptop story.
Yeah.
Would not have affected my vote for president. And I think there's maybe some interesting merit there in that story. But regardless, there was a centralized authority saying this is misinformation. Let's not only take the story off, we're going to kick off this media institution entirely.
I think the issue certainly is, you know, who defines what is misinformation, who is disinformation. That's always going to be a perennial question unless we allow just anything to be published that anybody chooses to publish. But, you know, to pretend that curation hasn't been part of the media scene forever, I mean, that's just not true. And frankly, while I certainly share your concerns about governments weaponizing any form of social media, whether it's Twitter or anything else, because that's serious. And we're already seeing in Russia and other places that claims of disinformation are being used to suppress what I would call legitimate journalism. So I agree with all that. But again, who's going to be the one that's going to decide this is ultimately the question. And for me, I would just like to see a proliferation of sources so that people would have options from which to choose. I think that's preferable than setting up a system that says Elon Musk or anybody else decides what's true or false. As a lawyer, I know that courts aren't very good at deciding what's true or false, and we have even fewer rules and regulations in this context. Not that I'm arguing for rules and regulations. The European Union is, but I'm not.
Well, maybe we're making this all harder than it has to be. I mean, some things are vague or gray and maybe difficult to determine the perfect truth of, but some are real easy, like Eric's point. There was no pedophile ring operating out of a pizza parlor. If you're putting that out, I'm either going to block that tweet or I'm going to block you. I could do that one. Throw me another one and I'll let you know. If you want to say that I won the last presidential election and you didn't, I'm very comfortable censoring that in some way, including kicking the president off when we thought democracy or our health hung in the balance. I mean, what's hard about that?
Well, the point is, of course, that those are decisions that were made by, in those days, you know, a publicly traded company, Twitter. Mr. Musk says he's going to take Twitter private. So there will be limited regulation from the SEC and other groups about just his finances and basics transparency.
Yeah.
So, I mean, again, I get all that. But I think ultimately, it's a private company, non-governmental. It can do what it wants. And if you don't like it, then choose another platform.
You know, that's the hypocrisy of me, isn't it, Jane? Because all along I said, hey, it's a private company. It's not free speech. I mean, you get to say whatever you want. All this private company is saying is you can't be on our platform. And that should be the right of a private corporation, even if it's super big like Twitter or Facebook. I completely supported their authority there. And now that the ball's in the other court and Elon Musk may launch Donald Trump back on Twitter, I'm like, oh, wait a minute, wait, we gotta rein this private company in. We've got to strap them down somehow, because that's the elephant in the room, to be honest with you. I'm worried about the divisiveness, the anxiety, the falsehoods that would come with an active Donald Trump Twitter account. Even though Trump says he still wouldn't do it, I suspect he would get back on Twitter. And don't we all suppose Musk would have him back on there?
I expect that will happen if Trump wants to go back on there. And of course, that is an issue. It also is an issue about whether, you know, what is the nature of these platforms? I mean, we are kind of assuming a market domination here, which may be the case now. It won't necessarily stay that way, especially if Musk operates in a way that drives people away. But this is part of the reason, I think, that in Congress, we're seeing these efforts to engage in new kind of antitrust actions against these platforms, because their argument essentially is that they have become so dominant in the marketplace that they are sort of something people are going to turn to, whether they ought to or not, and that they therefore ought to at least be broken up. But if not, they ought to be regulated. That'll be a tough sell, although there are a lot of Democrats that support that idea. And the first thing that they would want to do, I think, is to repeal Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, so that Twitter or any other social platform would become liable for illegal speech, and there are some categories of illegal speech that is posted on their platform by a user. Right now, if it's user-generated content, they're not going to be liable for it.
Well, what is your take on that? It seems to me like if you did that, if you impose that, if you remove that protection from these social media platforms, you would basically kill them, because moderating content to make sure that things didn't get posted would be prohibitively expensive, right? I mean, you couldn't, possibly.
That was the argument when Congress passed Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act in the last century. I would remind you, it was in the 1990s that it was passed. I would argue, and I'm not arguing necessarily for the elimination of Section 230, but I would just point out that I think with the advent of algorithms and other kinds of automated software, I think it's a lot easier for them to do that content moderation today than it once was. And we already see it happening in instances like YouTube, for example. Just a simple example, in Thailand, it's a criminal offense to disrespect the royal family. YouTube is very adept at taking down anything that is posted there that is disrespectful of, or even critical about the royal family. It can be done. It can be done, I think. And I'm not a technician. I can't tell you exactly how, but the technology has advanced considerably in the last 25 years.
Say Trump comes back on Twitter. If the divisiveness, the hate, or the deceit that he might launch is kind of already baked into the Twitter sphere, that it's not going to be a sea change. It's maybe going to be upsetting, but it's not going to be the playmaker that it was last time.
Yeah, I just think we have to think maybe more broadly than the individual examples. And I think there's a real risk of saying things like a lot of the Musk commentary has talked about, has kind of equated the defense of the principle of free speech. I'm not talking about the First Amendment, but just the principle of free speech as enhancing white supremacy or apartheid. And that is just so deeply at odds with history, in my opinion, that like censorship and repression were instrumental to slavery, were instrumental to Jim Crow, were instrumental to apartheid South Africa. Listen to Nelson Mandela talk about free speech. It's truly amazing. And Frederick Douglass, I think, has the best line about it, which is that the right of speech is very precious, is a very precious one. The right of speech is a very precious one, especially to the oppressed. As a principle, that is still worth defending. And then when we get whipped up on like, oh, it's a billionaire Elon Musk, or oh, that might mean that Donald Trump gets back on, the discussion gets a lot more polarizing. But to me, that principle is still quite worth defending.
I absolutely agree with that. That's an argument I have with my students all the time, who claim that free speech oppresses minorities and so forth. And I've tried to explain to them that it was a very powerful tool for social justice throughout the centuries. And they need to be very careful about what it is that they're going to try to suppress. So I'm with you on that. Absolutely.
Well, the argument gets made is that social media has really, really changed the playing field when it comes to free speech, that it has given everybody a megaphone, and what they're shouting into that megaphone is toxic to our civic culture in a way that free speech, when someone is at Bughouse Square here in Chicago standing on a soapbox preaching at the people walking by, is not. Or somebody doing a pamphlet or a leaflet and distributing it, putting it under windshield wipers in his neighborhood. That when you have these, when you have given so many people the ability to speak to so many other people and say whatever the hell they want, that this has really changed how we should think about expression and speech. I don't know how much I agree with that, but I certainly would agree with the idea that social media has really had a profound effect on shaping the way our culture operates.
I like that observation, Eric. I mean, it's almost funny that one word describes both things. I can tweet and reach the whole planet, that's speech, or I could stand on the courthouse square and reach 10 people that happen to be walking by. Are all of those speech, and should they all be governed by the same rules? Or maybe Twitter is kind of a game changer, or Facebook, these giant platforms.
You and I have talked about this in the past, John, and one of the things that has always troubled me about these social media platforms is that they tend to become the property of people that do not have any real background in free expression. I'm thinking in terms of journalists and media companies to start with, but there are lots of people that are practitioners of free expression, so I don't want to suggest it's a closed shop. But I think it's pretty clear that what has been driving people like Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk is basically money. If a particular pattern or operating system is going to generate a lot of revenue, then they're just thrilled to bits. And if it's poisoning the public discourse, hey, maybe that is a feature, not a bug, because it's getting them more clicks or getting them more advertising dollars or whatever it is that they're seeking. Whether it's an exercise of raw power for somebody like Elon Musk, I'll leave it to others to decide. But I guess my point is that for all of their trumpeting of free speech principles, going back to Section 230, they tend, in my experience, to, when it serves their purpose, they'll say, oh, we're publishers, we're curating, we're making, you know, important decisions about protecting the public from misinformation. When they're challenged on that, they suddenly say, oh, we're just a neutral platform. We're just here to provide the public square for people and, you know, nothing to do with us. And I find that incredibly hypocritical. And I think it's driven in part by the fact that they see this as essentially an economic move, a power move, has nothing to do with public discourse, public education, certainly not with altruism. And maybe I'm old and too idealistic, but it just seems to me that if they are becoming the prominent voice or dominating voice for public discourse, then we've got a problem. And this is where media literacy training and even critical thinking skills are so essential, so the public knows how to engage with this stuff.
Is there any way that this is worth $44 billion, this platform? I just can't imagine that it is.
I can't imagine that it is either, unless it's again, purely an ego-driven thing for Mr. Musk, you know, to say that he's got it. I mean, my understanding is that a chunk of his money has actually come from loans, and now you were also saying from Tesla. I'd love to know who those loans are coming from. We were talking about Saudi Arabia before. This money could be dark money, too.
One other thing that I heard that he was thinking about doing was making it so that people who pay him money, like you subscribe to Twitter, it's right now it's free. If people who aren't on Twitter don't know this, you can have a free account, post all you want. There's a premium, I forget what it's called, like Twitter Blue.
Yeah.
That he thinks that he can somehow have people paying money to have extra features like an edit button or so on. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think there's that much extra value in it. People already feel like they spend too much time on Twitter.
I think that's true, although there'll probably be some that will do it. The other point that I guess I would make just quickly is I'm not comfortable with the idea of Elon Musk and his cohorts having access to personal information that Twitter users are basically surrendering to Twitter and other social media. I'm not comfortable with any of them doing it, but given Mr. Musk's profile, I would think twice about that as well.
To the point of the valuation, though, I mean, there's a good case to be made, I think. Musk has made sitting in a Tesla is fun. The guy like knows how to make a great user experience for has proven that he can do that in products. And he's proven that perhaps his greatest invention of all is Tesla stock. He has made Tesla stock, you know, explode, 250, whatever, thousandfold over the last few years. And that's what people are thinking about when they're thinking about evaluation is, do I get in on this? Do I bet on Elon Musk? And if I'm betting on Elon Musk to make a return on my money, he has a pretty decent track record of that.
But if he's taking
I think it's more speculative.
Mm-hmm. But he's taking it private.
Yeah.
He's taking it private. So that's, I mean, I agree with you that he's done that with Tesla, but that's kind of irrelevant to what he's going to do with Twitter if he's turning it private.
He might make more money, but at $54.20, that's the last you're going to get for a share as a public shareholder now. Okay, Jane, it's nice to talk to you. She's the director of the Silla Center for the Study of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota. Jane, thanks for your insight and thoughts today. Very interesting.
Thank you, John.
Eric pointed out in a note to us that Chicago sees the most violent weekend this year, this past weekend. 37 people were hurt and 7 people killed by gunfire. Eric, you wrote, Mayor Lori Lightfoot declared 2022 a make-or-break year for tamping down on surging violent crime. This weekend proved to be the year's first major stumbling block. And I'll point out that Tuesday night, Will Klinger, 64-year-old host, once of WTTW's Wild Chicago, and now the host of a show called Wild Travels, was assaulted on the Red Line at the Addison, the Wrigley stop. The door opened up on his train. Someone grabbed his phone. He gave chase. He said, don't do that. But he did, and an accomplice evidently blindsided him with a blow to the head. He said maybe it was a pipe. Knocked him unconscious. Eventually, he was admitted into intensive care. I talked to Teal Hardiman of Violence Interrupters in Chicago about this. That's a volunteer group that tries to intervene and de-escalate dangerous situations. They're going to ride the Red Line again Friday night from 8 to midnight. I appreciate their intentions, but it underscores to me how undermanned the trains and buses in Chicago are. And I said to Teal on the radio, God bless you, but this is not your problem to fix. It's your problem to live in and to navigate, but this is the CTA's problem, and it's the city's problem, and I don't think they're throwing enough resources at this.
So I ride my bike more than the train, but this weekend I was downtown to go see on Saturday. I was in the Loop on a weekend for the first time in probably, I don't know, 6 months to a year. I'm rarely in the downtown on the weekend. And I went to go see Wilco on Saturday at the Auditorium Theater. And it was amazing. And I left the theater and was walking back with friends up Wabash. And this was maybe around 8 p.m., 8:30, 9-ish. And it was really an uncomfortable walk. Like a lot of people, folks jumping on cars, fights breaking out, people getting shoved. It was more than just like, oh, yeah, we're in a big city. Like, there's wild stuff going on a lot. It was uncomfortable.
This wasn't the Wilco crowd. This was just random folks.
Yeah, this was the old. This was random folks, probably, you know, 5-6 blocks north. And and then got on the brown line going north. And there was violence on the train. The train had to stop. A couple people had to get kicked off. Police had to come. And I'm thinking this summer, Chicago really needs to do a lot to bring a lot of tourism back to the city in order for our economy to kind of get back on the right track and have some of these businesses continue to operate after dealing with so much the last 2 years. And I can't imagine someone coming from another city and like having a pleasant experience on a regular Saturday night downtown if that's what they're experiencing.
Well, I can, as long as you don't ride public transportation. I think that's the Achilles heel of the thing, because people might not come or can't use the city the way they should. But as a guy who's downtown every day and comes downtown on a lot of weekends for restaurants or entertainment, you know, listen to me, I don't want to discourage people from coming downtown either. But to me, this is very much a CTA problem. It's bigger than that, but I'm just focusing on the CTA problem right now. And I don't sense the urgency from the powers that be, Eric.
Isn't what Austin experienced part of a – there was a whole group of people who showed up just downtown. I think they were teenagers. I'm not sure. I was out of town. I didn't follow the stories carefully. But my reading of the story was that the number of youths who showed up downtown just kind of to make trouble – was far larger than the Chicago Police Department had anticipated. And this caused a lot of tumult downtown. And I assume it spilled over onto the train. Is that your experience?
Yeah. Awesome? Oh, totally. And yeah, I would say, and maybe I wasn't on, you know, Michigan Ave or State Street or like the bigger thoroughfares, but Wabash isn't like a nothing street. Like it's a couple blocks over from those streets. And if you're a tourist and you wander and you want to go have dinner there, you could easily have ended up there. And it was super uncomfortable. And I think if anyone would have saw it, they probably would have turned the other way. We needed to get on a train, but there's definitely CTA is a problem for sure, but just street level kind of like keeping the chaos a little bit under control. That was also a problem downtown, at least that evening.
And were you thinking, boy, am I stupid because I could have anticipated this. I'm not a tourist. I know what Chicago's like.
I felt so silly. I was with people who had to take the train back, but I had my bike with me. So I'm walking around with a bike and my backpack and stuff. And I'm like, I'm asking for something silly to happen.
Did you have a sign that said rob me also, or was that not necessary at that point?
Unnecessary.
Well, Teal Hardeman talks about violence interrupters, and certainly jobs programs are important, improving education and so on. But immediately, if you're talking about this summer, you're not, these kind of things are not really going to kick in. And so you're going to need to have security or police on the trains, on the platforms. So the things that happened to Will Klinger and things that happened to, I mean, the story about Will Klinger is terrible. We're finding out about it because it was Will Klinger. Yeah. He's someone we all know about. Yeah. People are getting mugged and assaulted on CTA trains all the time. And that could have a devastating effect ultimately on the tourism and on the local economy. And so it's got to be a priority to put money on that problem and put personnel on it. And, you know, I don't see any other immediate answers other than just person power to control that, the mayhem, the chaos.
I forget what the number was, but there are so many trains and so many buses. My suggestion that they have another person on every CTA train that's always running, just walking up and down like on Metra. They say that's prohibitively expensive. We can't afford that. Then maybe do co-opt some of these volunteer groups. Although I told Teal, I said, You're not afraid, because I don't want to get on the train at 11 o'clock on a Friday night and ride the red line or the brown line. He said, oh, yeah, we got this. We got this. You know, we got martial arts experts, and we're familiar with these kids and these problems. And maybe they're more adept at it than I am. But if they're willing to be the guardian angels of the CTA, I'm willing to let them.
I think I facetiously recommended people who know karate go on the trains like a few weeks ago. And that is a real thing, right? They have a program that's like, there's some kind of martial artist thing that Hardeman talked about that.
Yeah.
That is real, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, he described the people, because I thought they were church pastors or congregants who, again, might know some of these people. I don't know who they were, but he said, no, these are trained wrestlers and martial arts guys and judo experts. It sounds so amateurish, it's almost sweet. But
let's try it.
But they're serious. And I'd rather sit next to a judo guy who's there to help than not.
Who's paying for this, though? I mean, these people are volunteering. Yes. And I know that this happens with the Guardian Angels in New York, that people will volunteer for a while. But people got to eat. They got to have... But, you know, they got to pay their rent, they got to pay for the car, and they got to pay off their student loans. They can't be riding the trains all the time protecting people and perhaps getting into really nasty altercations. I think that it's an intriguing idea, but I just don't think there are going to be enough of them who can afford to do it for long enough to really get a handle on this problem. And again, if the trains aren't safe, if riding the bus isn't safe, then you've got a huge problem in your city. And you know, New York is facing this kind of situation too, with the shooting on the subway platform and the train recently.
Yeah.
People have to have confidence in mass transit, because mass transit is what makes these cities possible. Everyone can't ride their bike to work like Austin, and can't drive to work like a lot of people do, because it just isn't going to happen.
That's the thing that I think is so sad, is that then you say, well, then don't get on the, hey, Austin, find another way to get home from the Wilco concert. But there's some people that are on the train at 4 a.m. and 5 a.m. because that's how they get to their job. And we are just saying, too bad for you. You know, you got no other, we can't help you, and you have no other choice. So you got to risk your life or your mental health every day that you get on the train. And that's just a daily reality for too many people. The status of the casinos in Chicago is what this week. And it seems to me like the needle hasn't moved much on aldermanic privilege that we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks on this podcast, that the people in whose wards the casinos might go still don't want it. The mayor still does. And it's kind of push come to shove still, right? The mayor wants more of a buy-in from the casinos. Eric, you pointed that out. But otherwise, it'll be interesting to see if a single alderman can put the brakes on something that will benefit the whole city.
I don't think there's been any big movement on any of the proposals. I think within the next, I believe, 3 or 4 weeks, this should start to congeal, and we'll be able to see where this might be located.
I don't see any way that this issue either way overturns aldermanic privilege. It might be that the council could see their way to carving something this major out as an exception to aldermanic prerogative privilege. But the more stories that I've read, there have been more stories coming out this week about how the aldermen in these areas are hardening against the proposal because their residents, the people who live near these proposed sites, are firmly against it. They'll take surveys, 80% of the people, they don't want the crime, they don't want the traffic, they don't want the 24/7 hubbub around a casino in their communities. I understand that. But it may just be that the council says, okay, we're going to have to, on something this large, something this significant, we can't let one alderman derail it. While still giving them the ability to control zoning in smaller ways. That might be a compromise solution here. But if they're going to hew to aldermanic privilege, the casino will not get built. We're going to right. in a month, it'll just be like, well, too bad. We can't find a place for it. So bye-bye. Thanks, Bally's.
Unless they can an alderman can see it as enough within their own interest that they don't even care if they lose their seat over it. I think that's one. Or there's a new secret location and they put the casino in the lake.
A floating casino, right? Like on a little
riverboat. That's why they had the riverboats, because it was legal.
They had to be on water. Yeah, that's right. So that they'd park the boat next to the street, and now it's on the water. That's the way all the towns did it.
Out on the intake cribs, they could put it out there.
Yeah, I mean, the boats never went anywhere, but they were technically on water then. You know, when Minneapolis built an airport and then expanded the airport, they introduced a lot of traffic and pollution and complications to some pretty nice neighborhoods on the south side of Minneapolis. And one of the things they told the people that lived in South Minneapolis and around Bloomington, Minnesota, where the Mall of America is and the airport is we'll do noise abatement. And then people that lived within various sort of concentric circles, depending on how close you were to ground zero, you got more stuff. And if you live further out, you got less stuff. But people got all new windows, all new doors, all new central air conditioning, all new insulation and noise abatement on their properties. It's amazing the amount of money they threw at homeowners, and each year it would just kind of expand a little further out. And when it got to your block, you'd say, hey, I wonder what we're going to get, you know, and you didn't get windows now because you knew in a couple of years the city was going to buy you windows because too bad for you, you live near the airport. I wonder if Chicago should think of something like that. So if you get a casino in your neighborhood, we're going to give you casino abatement. We're going to give you, I don't know what that would be, but maybe just money or chips. I don't know. But it would just seem to me like
a drink ticket.
They pay off your student loan.
I'm telling you.
Full circle.
That's what we do now. It would just seem to me like there might be a way to buy the accommodation of some people, accommodate some people. If you said, okay, we know this sucks for you, what does it take? What can we do to make this better for you?
There's a framework for that called the community benefits agreement or something like that. That is the term they were using around, you'll remember, the Obama presidential libraries. How do you sort of compensate folks around for dealing with this kind of intrusion into what they're doing? Maybe a casino who really wanted to stand out in the bidding process maybe should put forward something like that. Hey, we're going to, I'm sure that is in some of these proposals, but we're going to dedicate X million to residents in this way. And maybe that could sway a vote.
One last thing, Eric, I just wanted to talk about the NBA.
I'm on my high horse about this. I think there are way too many 3-point shots in NBA games. By watching the playoffs, when the NBA first introduced the 3-point shot back in like 79, like for the first few years, teams were averaging about 5 3-point shot attempts per game. Now it's up to 35 shots per game. The Bucks took more than 40 in one game. In the series, they're averaging, I think, 35 shots per team in the Bulls-Bucks series. The Bucks are making 38%. The Bulls are 28%. And that's a big reason why the Bulls are down 3-1, are probably going to lose Wednesday night and it'll be over. And the reason is the three-point shot has become too easy for too many of these players, especially the one in the corner, that if you just hoist up shots from the corner, three-point shots from the corner, the average is 1.16 points per attempt. But inside the arc, your average is like 0.79 points. And what that means is that statistically, you're kind of stupid to take a two-point shot when you can back up and take a three-point shot. If you got a dunk, okay, that's one thing, or a layup. But if you're taking a jump shot, like a 10, 12-foot jump shot, like we're all used to seeing, that's not a smart shot. And so they're just out there hoisting up these long shots all the time.
But the value proposition is better if you take a three than if you try and get inside there. So what is your problem? What do you want them to do about that?
Well, because the game is just these guys come down and they hoist up threes. You see guys passing up perfectly good open shots to try to get a three-point shot that might even be contested.
But they don't make the two-pointer. But the return on the two-point investment isn't as good as it is on the three-point investment,
well,
right?
Yeah, even if you don't make as many of them, yeah, it's worth it. So my argument would be that they need to move that three-point line back to the point where they find out statistically that it balances out. Like move it back a foot, move it back another foot and a half, so that it's and take away that corner three, which is way too short, especially in the pros.
Well, they got to make the court wider. But you aren't thrilled to watch the three-pointers go in? Those are beautiful things.
No, I'm not thrilled watching all.
You don't like Steph Curry's game?
I do. I mean, I like his game, yeah, but I prefer like Ja Morant's game. Well, did you see his poster dunk last night?
From Memphis. That is the best dunk I may have ever seen. Maybe I've seen better ones, but I don't remember them. That is the most awesome, and he dunks over somebody at some distance, and he's not 7 foot tall. It's a spectacular feat of athleticism.
Yeah, I'd much rather see them playing that sort of one-on-one game, that the passing, the layups. That's basketball as I kind of remember it, and I'm a little bit old school on that. But the three-point shot, it's too easy for some of these players, and they come down the floor, and it's like, don't take a two, take a three. In the long run, you're better off.
Do you want them to wear Keds, too? Or
I'd like them to have like little short shorts like they used to.
That's what I'm thinking.
Aesthetically, I can't say that I really dislike what basketball has become. I still think basketball is very entertaining. There was this revolution, almost like Moneyball in baseball, that showed that if you had a team that could shoot threes, your return was going to be so much higher. And Steph Curry being the epitome of that. And I also think there's some kind of beauty in seeing like, you have 7-footers now who are shooting threes, which was, you know, inconceivable in the past. But now you have these total freaks of nature coming out of Europe or a different planet or wherever they're from. And they're able to both post up and shoot threes over people that nobody can block. That's kind of cool to see. And we wouldn't see if, you know, we didn't have this knowledge that threes had a higher expected return. So I will say there's some nostalgia for like, we remember Michael Jordan as shooting mid-range jumpers and dunking, and hit that game was very beautiful. And you look at someone like a DeMar DeRozan, who's very good, does a lot in the mid-range game, and is probably would have been more successful in an earlier era of basketball. He might have been the best player in the 90s. Now he's one of the best, but not top tier.
He doesn't have a particularly good three-point shot. It's a problem. And then you look at like a Brooke Lopez on the Bucks, who's like you say, he's one of those 7-footers. He has no problem hoisting it up from outside, and I think he shoots pretty well from out there too. So it is a totally different game. And I just think as soon as you get to these games, and like the Bulls the other night when they fell behind, they just were in that throw up a three, hope that we can somehow claw our way back by hitting these shots.
Well, that was their only hope. I mean, with Antetokounmpo playing the kind of game he's playing, boy, there's this 6'11" guy who can also hit a three. His game. I don't know how you win when he's on the other team. But we did win one game, but you know the other sort of thorn for all of us Chicago Bulls fans is that one of the reasons that Milwaukee's done so well in the last two games is because Grayson Allen is just lighting it up from three, Eric. Maybe that's what this is all about. And he is killing us. He's not missing a thing. He's playing good basketball and he hasn't even injured anybody. We are out of time. Austin Berg, Eric Zorn, thanks for joining us. The rest of the gang all busy doing their 9-to-5s. So we appreciate you guys and Jane Kirtley from the Scylla Center being our special guest today. We're produced by Pete Zimmerman. I'm John Williams, and we'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNradio.com. Thank you.